This is a Gathering Heritage project interview recorded in County Louth in Ireland.
Now, I'm delighted to welcome to our Gathering Heritage project, Dominic Keating. Now, Dominic, of course, is very, very well known for a lot of things in Dundalk, particularly on the stage. And that is not what we're going to talk about on our programme today. Dominic, if I say Symington's, would you think a lot of people in Dundalk would remember Symington's?
They may not, because most people knew it as Dundalk Textiles. I spent 33 years in Dundalk Textiles. And it was only down Deary's Yard. But in actual fact, at the height of its production, there were 180 people worked there. When I went in first, I went in at age 15, and there were only 14 men, and the rest were all women. And
why are you laughing?
because I remember the first time I went in, and the first time we made corsetry, you know, women's corsetry. So I remember the first time I was sent down into the factory. I walked into stores at 15 years of age, and of course all the women were, you know, child in, you know, and you were red faced, and they loved to embarrass you, you know. Yeah.
Because you're right as regards the corsetry, because we wouldn't have known a hell of a lot, and a lot of people don't know what men. But we do know that they made corsets.
Yes, yes, they did. And of course, one of the big products they had was swimwear. We were at one stage the leading manufacturer of swimwear in Ireland. We also made sportswear, tracksuits. We made the kit for the Dundalk Football Club for years. And a lot of the business was export, because our parent company were in Leicester. They had loads of work, and they used to send it over to us. So we did a very big proportion of it, maybe 35% was exported. But it's amazing when you think about it. But in Dundalk, you never hear any mention of the what they call the needle trades, the clothing manufacturers. You hear about Halliday's and Clark Shoes, Rawson's, Connolly's. But in actual fact, if you think about it, all the needle trades was around Dundalk. I remember tailors in New Street, who made the Garda uniforms. There was the Pinny factory who made dresses. There was the Hankey factory. There was the Dundalk Hosiery Company. Yeah. There was Joe Blair's who had made the dresses. There was ourselves, Dundalk Textiles, Symington's. And then there was, later on, there was Liam Parker, who made slacks trousers. And then after that, Riverside. So there were an awful lot of people employed. I mean, you think about a small place, Dundalk Textiles, at the height of it, they had 180. The hosiery had about 60, 70. You know, so you can imagine all the people who are employed. But you never hear anything about it in Dundalk.
Yeah, that's a good point what you're making there, because immediately you think the textiles, and there's only a half a dozen people walking there, and you see them coming out on their bikes, and, you know, along with all the other places. But Dominic, just go back. How did you get involved in it? It was Symington's when you went to work in it.
Yeah, you see, when the company was formed in 1934, it was actually Dundalk Textiles, and they were manufacturing there a very limited range. But what happened was, because of the tariff barriers, the English companies wanted to come into Ireland to avoid the duties. So they would manufacture in Ireland and would avoid paying the duties. And Symington's, who were an English company based in Leicester, Market Harborough in Leicestershire, they came in and they formed. There were actually two companies there when I went in, even. I went in 1959. There were actually two companies and two separate sets of accounts, two separate stocks, because Dundalk Textiles actually manufactured mostly at that time for Woolworths, the Woolworth Group, with a massive amount of stores around the country. And we manufactured plastic baby pants for them, because it was all napkins that time, so it was plastic baby pants, handkerchiefs, what they call dress shields, souvenir packs of embroidered handkerchiefs and all that sort of thing. So we had a separate set of accounts for them and a separate set of accounts for Symington's, who were the main manufacturers. And through time, of course, the Dundalk Textiles sort of phased out production because the Woolworth stores all closed down.
Yeah, and so you and your brother And was there somebody else in, it took her over then?
Well, you see, at the time, I think it was around about 1987, Courtauld's decided to sell. It was the only, we were part of the Courtauld's group. Symington's were taken over by Courtauld's in the UK, and they took over the factory. And we were the only manufacturing unit they had outside the UK. So they wanted to offload this. At the time, so myself, my brother Frank, and Pat Muckian, Lord rest them, we actually took over the company, and in actual fact, we all remortgaged our houses to fund it.
That was a big thing to do, Dominic, back then, wasn't it? And first of all, can we just for anyone that didn't know where the textiles was in Dock, just explain to us where it was.
Well, it was down Deary's Yard, where Guineys are now. Down that yard there, and it was the old listed building, which we call the old factory, and then they built an extension which moved right over to the Christian Brothers School, and that's where it was located.
It was a fine big place down the back there. You wouldn't think there was all that down the back.
Yeah, it was very, very, very extensive. And it was state of the art when they did it at that time, because they put in automatic folding machines. They had transporters for the production lines. It was really top.
So what did you when you and Pat took over, your brother and Frank and Pat took over, did you change what they were manufacturing, or did you drop stuff like ladies' underwear? Did you keep doing all of that kind of stuff?
Well, we did a certain amount of it, but mostly we started to manufacture more sportswear and swimwear. The swimwear was very big because the bulk production really was for Dunns and Pennies and BHS, you know, mail order, and another mail order company called GUS, you know, big mail order companies in the UK, and that took over more and more of the production. But so the sportswear became a big part of it, actually.
Yeah. And was there a board, or was it just the three of you were complete charge?
It was just the three of us. We'd complete charge of it. And as I say, unfortunately for us, really, at the end of the day, we didn't have the finances to keep it going. So eventually we had to bring in venture partners who came in and put some money into the company. But it never, at that time, probably, the textile trade was in recession. I remember back in 1981 or 82, a guy called Eric Hardwick, who was the chairman of Courtauld's, our branch, had said to us that he reckoned that within 5 to 10 years, there would be no manufacturing units in Ireland or the UK, that it would all be transferred to North Africa and the Far East. And he was absolutely right, because the business, you couldn't compete. I remember I used to go around to the wholesale customers who were doing particularly the sportswear, and we did an awful lot of business in tracksuits. And I went over to a place called Ballinamore in County Leitrim. Crines were the big wholesalers in the West, and he used to buy the tracksuits off us, and I brought in a new range to him to show them. And he said to me, "Don't really show you this." And he went down to his own showroom, and he came back in, and he gave me a tracksuit, and he asked me, "What did I think of it?" And I looked at it, and I said, "It's very good quality fabric. It's very well made, you know." He said, "Well, I'll just show you the invoice for that." He was buying them in from China, and we couldn't buy the material for what he was buying the finished product for. We couldn't actually buy the material for that. That's what killed the market. So
that's, and that happened a lot of factories around Ireland.
Oh, closed. I know some of the bigger factories. I think I remember one factory in Dublin that we used to do some work for. They were making up to a quarter of a million garments a year, and they were out of business in 2 years.
Dominic, did you reduce the, when it started getting quieter, did you reduce the amount of people that was working there, or did you try to keep them going as long as you could?
We tried to keep them going as long as we could, but what happened was, with natural wastage, when people got married and retired or whatever, we didn't replace them. That's the way it was done. When we left in 1993, there were 65 people still employed there. You know, but it had gone down, you know, over the years it slimmed down from 180 and it slid right down to about 90 was consistent and then down to the 60s.
Yeah. I saw a lot of comments when I was doing a wee bit of research for talking to you, and the stories that came out of it was that it was a brilliant place to work. Now, were you conscious of it when Symington's were there, or when you took her over, did you change the outlook for the staff?
No, we tried to keep it much the same as it was. The thing about Dundalk Textiles was, or Symington's, some people call it, was that it was very progressive. For a start, and I went in 1959, there was a free excursion. They used to run a train from Dundalk, and they actually had the radio train, you know, the one with the radio on it. Yeah. They used to run excursions to Bangor, Portrush, Bray, Arklow, Galway. They were the ones I was on. Now, what they would do was, everybody was given a free ticket. You went up in the morning, got onto the station. When you were on the train, the accountant, who was Jerry Brennan, would go round and hand everybody an envelope with 10 shillings in it. Now, 10 shillings may not seem much, but at that time you could buy a turkey and ham dinner for 7 and 6 pence. You know, so you give the 10 shillings. There was also a free mineral bar on the train.
And why did you do that?
The company did it. This was the tradition in this company. They were very progressive. They always looked after. The money wasn't great, the wages, but they always had, you know, little perks like this. Yeah. And the radio train would run down, and we'd some terrific times. But like everything else, when people get something for nothing, they don't appreciate it. You were allowed, if you wanted to bring a partner, if you had a girlfriend or a wife or a husband, you could bring them, but you paid for them. But it came to the point where there were more outsiders than people who worked in the factory going on the excursion, so they stopped it. But the company, because they did that, they actually transferred the money they were spending on that into a medical fund. So allowed us to set up, we had a committee, and we set up a medical fund so that people could go to the chemist or whatever with the prescriptions, and we would pay for the prescriptions from the fund. So they weren't taking the money back.
Was it a worrying time? Like, was the enthusiasm when you took it over, were you full of enthusiasm? Could you see yourselves multimillionaires? Like, is that the way it was at the beginning?
You would never be a multimillionaire or a millionaire in the textile trade. But we thought we could make a good living out of it, a fair living out of it, and we thought we could do well. But unfortunately, we didn't have the resources ourselves to fund it, and we didn't get much backing from the IDA. But eventually, you know, myself and Frank were really forced to leave. But we got our redundancy out of it, and we set up a small business on our own in the same line. But the textiles were great years. I mean, we were the first people in Dundalk to introduce a 4.5-day working week. At that time, when I went in first, you worked 44 hours a week, 5 days Monday to Friday, and then the half day on Saturday. And then as the working hours were reduced over a period of time back to 39 hours, when we got to the 39 hours, it was decided they would ballot the people in the factory to reduce the lunch hour to a half an hour and just work until 1 o'clock on Friday. So we're the first people in town to have that.
And you introduced that yourself?
Yes. It was a sort of a way of giving people something extra, sort of an extra long weekend. Not that we ever got it, because by that stage we were in the management, and you know, you weren't paid for overtime, but you expected to be there, so we would be there until 5 o'clock on a Friday.
Did you put much work during the years that you? How many years were there?
33 years.
And did you, shall we say, give half your life to it at the time you were there?
Oh, absolutely. Because as I say, you and the staff, you didn't get paid for overtime, but you still expected to do it. I would often bring work home at the weekends and work maybe put 5, 6, 7 hours at the weekend into it as well. Yeah, because we sort of grew up in it and sort of thing. It was sort of like, you know, it was your life, you know, and you tended to do that.
What was the conditions like in it? I saw some photographs in it. Like, was it a cramped conditions, or was it very enjoyable? Did the people enjoy working there?
I think everybody enjoyed. I know it. I would maintain they were the best years of my life, really. You know, I made so many friends, friends for life, people that are, you know, long left the trade, but you meet them and it's like you never left. You know, the everybody who ever walked in it would always say, oh, it was a great place to walk. As I say, the money was never great, but there was always this these little extras, you know. Like, we formed a small little place that we formed our own variety group. We put on shows in the town hall and filled the town hall.
We did De La Salle's?
No, before that, as Dundalk Textiles, we called it the Textiles Variety Group, and we had we filled the town hall for two nights, and we would do the booking in the factory, you know, and we even had guys made the scenery. There was nobody from outside involved, only the accompanist. And the late Jimmy Bellew, he was a friend of Seamus McGuinness's, came in and produced the shows for us. But we were our own variety group, and then, like the usual show we'd have, you know, yourself in those places. But guys got together, we would go out to Mount Pleasant to play indoor football twice a week, and we'd a fishing competition, and there was a little social club, and there was all sorts of activities, you know, to make up.
And that was a lot that wasn't in other factories.
No. I think the only people who had anything similar was PJ Carroll's. PJ Carroll's had a good social club. I think the brewery eventually had one as well, but we had it, I think, before anybody else had it. And it was great fun. And it was great company that people sort of seemed to like to come into work, you know. And there were lots of families. I mean, I was there, my brother was there, David Hertie was there, his father Peter was there, Tom Gern was there, his uncle thing was there. We had five Maguire sisters. You know, we had four of the Fagan sisters. They tended to be, you introduce other members of your family into the company, and that's the way they recruited. We very seldom advertised outside.
Yeah, and how did you sell? Had you a salesman or a few salesmen going around the country?
Well, there was an agent at one stage, but then they dispensed with the agent because they felt that the commission was too much, you know, was too difficult. My brother Frank became the sales director, and eventually, over the years, he actually did all of the what we call the house accounts, like the Dunns, the Pennies, the BHS, and I did all the retail and the wholesale accounts around the country. I would start off in Ballinamore and County Leitrim and walk my way right round the coast. You know, we could get calls in Sligo, Ballina, Limerick.
Yarl. And would you be doing cold calling?
Well, what we would do is we'd sort of keep in contact by phone, but once every couple of months, I would do a week going around the country to the, because they were mostly wholesale accounts. You see, you would call the wholesale accounts like the bigger wholesalers in the west and south and coming up the east coast. And we do that once every, so as I say, every two or three months to keep in contact with the customers, introduce any new...
So gradually, could you see when you were going around on them trips that it was getting more difficult with probably because you said earlier with the stuff coming in?
Yeah, very much so. The cheap imports began to take effect. And because we are such a small economy, what happened was, you see, there was a percentage of imports through the EEC at that time. But if you think about it, an awful lot of these imports came into the UK, and 4% in the UK wasn't that much. But when the UK started selling, because the free movement wants to come into the EU, so an awful lot of stuff was coming the back door to Ireland. It's got very difficult to sell eventually, you know.
And Dominic, you mentioned a few minutes ago about all the different needle factories that was in the town. Were they all feeling the pinch at that time as well?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I think, apart from Riverside, who were there, and Liam Parker, who was still going at that stage, we were almost the last of the needle trades. The Penny Factory, Taylors, Joe Blair, the Hosiery Company, the Hankey Company, they all closed. They all closed because of competition.
You hear about all these, like when you go up to Pennies now, but all the cheap things is coming in and the sweat shops and everything like that. But what you're talking about now is real Dundalk lives, the effect it had on you.
Well, that's true. And the thing about it was, there was so little mention in the local media when those places closed. The Hosiery Company closed because of a fire. I don't know whether you remember that or not. There was a fire. There were in Mary Street North. Mm-hmm. Big fire there, and they closed down. And But apart from that, there was no real attention paid to all the jobs that were lost in the illegal trade.
There was more, though, talk about shoes. Shoes seemed to be the thing that everyone was talking about. Even to this day, people say it was a shoe town.
Yeah, well, it was a shoe town. There were Connolly's Hallidays, or Clark's and Rawson's. Yeah. But also, I don't know whether you notice or not, on the lampposts around the town, they have these little things up on the lampposts commemorating the industries in town. I happened to look around them last week. I was walking around. They mention almost every industry in town. Not one of them mentions one of the needle trades, the clothing factory.
Is that what they were known as, needle trade?
Needle trade, anything in the clothing terms, the needle trade.
They didn't make needles. They didn't do needles.
Needle trade because it was machines, you know. And but I noticed that, you know, that it's almost forgotten. I mean, there was no mention about the Hankey Company or Taylor's. Very little mention of them closing down in the local media. You know, the textiles closed down and there was never publicised. Mm-hmm. And there was 65, 69 jobs lost overnight.
Was it a worrying time for you when things started going wrong? And did you decide if further down, if it gets any worse, we're going to go? Or did you try to keep going as long as you could?
We kept trying. We kept trying to the very end until eventually we had to make up our mind and say, look, there's no way we're going to be able to finance this ourselves. We do need some sort of outside help. We were introduced to a company, a venture partner who came in and took over the business. But of course, because of that, we had to surrender our shares because they would only come in for a majority share. So we had no say in the running of the business after that. And that meant that we were merely in doing a job. But eventually, as I said, we were really forced out of it. Myself and Frank set up a small business. We employed about 8 or 9 people. And Frank stayed in that business until he retired.
And where was that?
70 years of age. Distillery Lane. What was the old... it actually was the old post office building. Remember the engineering part? Used to have cables and added there. We had a unit in there. There were 1, 2, 3, 4 units in there. There was Marnus Foods. There was Cureprint. There was ourselves. And there was Cathy Pendergast. That was the leather handbags and whatever. They were all in that little building. So that's where we went.
Was it difficult for you working though under somebody else after being in charge for that many years?
Well, it was definitely because we had knowledge of the business. They had no particular expertise in that field, but they felt that they knew better than us. And I mean, it was constant meetings. The day to day end of the business, the running of the business, was forgotten about, and I think to the detriment of the business, because eventually that's what happened. I mean, we left in August and it was closed the following February.
Agree.
Yeah, we left in August, the 9th of August I think it was, and by the following February it had closed down completely overnight, really.
And when you took it over, did you take over the buildings and everything? You took over the whole lot and you had to hand all of that back. And was it that a very tough time?
It was a tough time. And the business was freehold. I mean, the buildings were freehold and all of the machinery and everything else. We took over everything. But apart from that, you know, they say there's always a silver lining to every cloud. And we both ended up, I briefly, for a couple of years with Frank in that business before I moved on and eventually became manager of the Job Initiative in Dundalk, which I 12 great years in before I retired.
You loved that job.
I absolutely loved it because it was a challenge, really, because it was being set up from scratch. There was, at that time, there was an awful lot of unemployment, particularly long-term unemployment. And that scheme looked after people who were over 35 years of age, who had been more than 5 years in the live register. They were taken in and given full-time jobs at full-time wages in the local voluntary sector. And they were also retrained and upskilled. Mm. And there was a 3-year programme where hopefully would move on to employment.
But you got good skills working in the textiles and the treating people like that. And the people now, I'm sure that you still know, there's loads of them alive, yeah. And but you probably know every one of them walking up the town. Would they still mention it to you?
Absolutely. Every time, I met a girl called, well, Marie Nolan, I know her as, I don't know what her married name is, and I haven't seen her in 20 years, and I met her in Boyd's shopping centre the other day, and she said, oh God, Dominic, I haven't seen you in years. And it was, you know, the textile, the whole talk was about the textile, and do you meet many of them, you know, this is always the thing, do you meet many of them, you know, whatever, like, of the men, there are very few around. There's Frank, my brother Frank, so we started, there's Tom Gernon, there's Paddy McGuinness, who went on to work in PJ Carroll's, but we're about the only ones left from the original group that I worked with, went into the textiles with.
What would you, if you're looking back on it, Dominic, was there something you did, Frank, you and Pat, that maybe you, if you had to go and do it again, you would change?
Yes, I would, and I'll tell you what it was. When Court Dolls decided to sell the business, they were looking at doing several interested parties, they told us that whoever would come in would probably have their own management team, and they actually offered us a deal. Myself and Frank were offered a deal, a very generous deal. And at the time, we sort of felt a loyalty to the workforce because we've been there all our lives. And we decided to try for the management buyout instead. But in actual fact, what we should have done with hindsight was to take the offer and set up the business we set up. We would have been better able to finance the business. We would never have had to take a second mortgage out in our houses. You know, it would have been a completely different picture, but of course, it's easy to say that when you look back. But yeah, that's the one mistake that we made.
Now, you're involved in a lot of things with the Musical Society, and I know you do a part-time job up the town as well for
the Citizens Information.
Citizens Information for Marie up there, yeah. And if you're sitting here on your own thinking about, which we all reminisce a bit to ourselves, would you think more about the textiles than anything else that you... I know you love the Musical Society, but in a different way, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, and it's a strange thing. I still dream all the time about the textiles. And I sometimes wake up, I'm thinking, you know, in a bit of a sweat, think we should have gotten that order out, that has to go out today, and I wake up and realise, God, I'm not there any longer. But I still dream about it. You dream about all the people in the textiles that you worked with. It's almost
can
my
you see it in your mind's eye all the time?
Absolutely. I can nearly, you know, in your mind's eye, walk through the factory and through the different departments and see the same people and whatever. I remember when I went in first, I worked in the stores, and we had something like 5,000 different items, and that was my first job. And I used to when I went first, one thing I wanted to do was to find out where everything was. So I the system where I used to start memorising what was in each bin, you know, right through the place. And the end result of it is that even today I can remember numbers, but I can't remember names, because I was always dealing in numbers. And I can remember numbers. Even phone numbers, I never put phone numbers on my phone, like, one, you know, people put them in 1, 2, 3, 4. I can remember the numbers off the top of my head. I ring them all the time.
Talking to you now for this past half hour, I can see that you're very passionate about the whole time you're in it, that you get very sentimental about it, the years you spent in it. And if you now think back, would you do it again? You know, do you regret doing that, or the great memories to look back on?
The great memories. I'd love to do it all again. I'd love to do it all again. With such happy times. We're very busy. I mean, the thing about it is that it was, you know, yourself, when you work in a factory, it's all pressure. But the thing is that everybody seemed to be so happy doing it. There was always a laugh and always a bit of crack, and there's always, you know, this extracurricular activity when we were out together and we did things together and played football or whatever. So there was always something going on. because I remember that the other thing we had was Christmas parties, and the idea of the Christmas party was that the company financed everything, but the ladies would look, the committee would look after the catering, and the men would put on the entertainment. They, you know, put on a bit of a show every Christmas in the canteen. That's, you know, you had all these little things going on in the factory that added to the pleasure of working there.
Did you ever try a reunion?
We did one. Some of the girls actually did it. It was lovely. About 3 years ago, they organised a mass first in St Nicholas's for all of the people. And we teamed up with Liam Parker, company, because Liam wasn't well, he couldn't be there himself, but some of his employees came along because some of them had moved from the textiles into there, and they arranged a lovely little mass, and then we went out to Lisdoo, and we had people had taken photographs out and old photographs and everything, and we had a disco, and it was great to meet people, because it was the first time, I think it was the first time there was a reunion since the factory closed. Yeah, although some of the girls I know there's a whole group of the girls meet every month. They meet for coffee. There's a whole group of them meet out in the Lisdoo for coffee every month.
Would you not have one final one?
I wouldn't mind it, actually. That's a good suggestion. I might try it.
Yeah, I think. Well, I mean, it should be no problem to you. You get plenty of entertainment in anyway.
It's food for thought. It is, yeah. Indeed.
And this might, you see, now people that listen to this might get their memories going.
Yeah, well, there are an awful lot of people. I mean, if you think about it, at that time, you know, particularly in a factory like that, where it was all women, they got married and they left, and a new group of people came in. So there must be hundreds and hundreds of people out there who worked in the textiles, who have memories of it. Yeah, who, you know, and the difficulty is trying to communicate with these people, yes, you know, yes. to get the word across, you know.
The final thing I want to ask you is that you made ladies' underwear and you made corsets and everything. Did the ladies get them at a reduced price, or were they charged, or did you just give them to them for nothing?
Oh, no, they would get them at the wholesale price, the factory price. They always did that, yeah. And in actual fact, what they call the seconds, there might be very little flaws in them at all, as you know, same in a shoe company. And they were all sold off at half price. The girls would have first chance.
And why was there no men's underwear?
Well, you see, we never read that. That was more the hosiery company. The hosiery company in Mary Street North actually did men's underwear, but we didn't. But my brother has a good one. My brother Frank has a good. He was a salesman for a long time, sales director for a long time. But he has a great one of coming to customs from England, and he'd asked, been over to the parent company. There's a big case full of samples coming back, and he was stopped by customs. And the customer said, what do you do? And he said, I travel the ladies' underwear. And the customer said, you what? He travel the ladies' underwear. He says, I've come in here, they want to see them. And he started to open the case, and the customer said, no, close it up.
Dominic, thank you very much indeed for that. Great, great memories.
Thanks very much for having me on, Harry.
Listen to lots more epic interviews at gatheringheritage.com.